Good morning, everyone. It's good to see everyone this morning. When we was talking about Dennis about sleepy and all, or late night, is about a quarter to two, I think, when I went to bed, so there's no telling what I'm going to say this morning. But when we were talking about service, I remember a little story about church services one time. Some brought pictures of servicemen that had died in service to the country. But a child overheard people talking about someone dying in the service, and that child asked his folks, said, was that the morning service or the evening service? Well, maybe some of you are going to feel that way this morning. Mention a couple of things, kind of do some a little bit of custodial work here, and I got a call actually from a cousin in Tulsa, but another cousin of mine lives in Richmond, right in the Houston area, and they said that they had 18 inches of rain right now, and it was up, water was into their yard, and also an outbreak of tornadoes in that particular area, and so they were more concerned maybe about that even than they were the water. They live in a two-story home, so they thought probably water was going to end up in the house, but still would save their house as far as the home, but that way. But they were, at least right now, was more concerned about an outbreak of tornadoes. And, of course, they asked for all of us to remember all of that area in our prayers, and we certainly want to do that. Another thought is that next Sunday morning, I think here in the adult class, as well as some of the other classes that we have, is starting a new quarter of Bible classes. You know, we're all creatures of habit, and sometimes it's hard to break habits, and sometimes it's hard to make good habits. Good habits for me, of course, is I'm talking about making it to Bible classes. Bad habits is to get into a kind of a mold and say, well, I've got an hour here, and I'm going to be here at 11 o'clock, and I'm going to leave at 12 o'clock, and we kind of get into that mold too, when probably all of us in reality would have to say 10 o'clock's not all that early, and probably we would all have to say that an hour of Bible study, or 45 minutes, usually about 40 to 45 minutes, would be beneficial to my spiritual life. What I'm asking you to do is to think about that. Think about that this week, and we'd love to see. I set a goal in my own mind some time back to have 100 each Sunday morning, 100 for Bible classes, and I don't know that I've promoted that well, but I haven't given up on it yet either, and so really encourage you to be here. Now, if I'm not here next week, it'll be because of can't be. After saying all that, please stop and think about spiritual life and how you can grow, and give that some real thought. This morning, I want us to think about a topic, and the introduction is going to be kind of long, and you're going to think it's disjointed from what I'm going to talk about. I want to talk about loving and caring Christians. Bob read something a little while ago that centers on the fall of Jerusalem. The story of the fall of Jerusalem in 586 B.C. to the Babylonians is recorded in 2 Kings chapter 25, 2 Chronicles chapter 36, and Jeremiah chapter 39. Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, he brought his army to camp around Jerusalem. No one could enter or leave the city. And when the food in the city was gone, Judah's army, along with King Zedekiah, they broke through the wall during the night in an attempt to escape. The armies of Nebuchadnezzar, though, pursued, and they overtook Zedekiah in the plains of Jericho. They captured him. They scattered his army. Zedekiah, his sons, and other captives, they were brought to Nebuchadnezzar at Riblah, where judgment was pronounced upon them. You can imagine, as a father, King Zedekiah was forced to watch while his sons were killed. After they were killed, his own eyes were put out. He was bound in bronze chains, and he was taken to Babylon. Later, the captain of Nebuchadnezzar's guard returned to Jerusalem and literally destroyed everything. He took the valuables from the temple. He sent them to Babylon. He took the structures apart piece by piece and left a pile of rubble. Everything that could be burnt, he set on fire. The temple, the houses of the king, Jerusalem's officials. He broke down the walls. He took the people captive and he sent them to Babylon as slaves. He left only a few poor people back in the area of Judah, Jerusalem, to work the land and the vineyards. Judah, once the proud jewel of Israel, was held hostage by the very people she had courted and whose gods she had come to respect. Jerusalem itself, once a very bustling commercial and religious center, lay in a heap of ashes. What the people thought could never happen, it had happened to them. There was a prophet who had warned Jerusalem over and over again. We call him the weeping prophet, and he's Jeremiah. Jeremiah was in prison at the hands of his own people when Jerusalem was destroyed. The Babylonians freed him from prison, and they treated him with a measure of respect. They gave him a choice of going to Babylon or to remain in his homeland, and he chose to remain in his native country. After the destruction of Jerusalem, God told Jeremiah to write down what he saw and how he felt about it. And we read those feelings in the book which we call Lamentations. Jeremiah must have walked through the city streets shortly after the destruction. He probably saw a lot of dead bodies in those streets and huge piles of stone that used to be his beloved city. His feelings of hopelessness and helplessness were expressed in agonizing groans of disbelief. How could this happen? Judah was experiencing the plight of a nation whose God had been turned over to the other gods she had worshipped. And Judah learned the lesson that false gods cannot help in times of need. Jeremiah's sadness was even worse because of the fact that he tried to tell the people what was about to happen, but they would not listen to him. He knew it did not have to happen. Destruction came because they had refused to believe that Jehovah God is the only true God. And in Lamentations, we find him weeping. In essence, he's giving a funeral message for the calamity that had come upon Judah and Jerusalem. And that's really our text in Lamentations this morning, in particular, these verses. Lamentations 1, verse 1. How lonely sits the city that was full of people. How like a widow has she become. She who was great among the nations. She who was a princess among the provinces has become a slave. Jerusalem sinned grievously, therefore she became filthy. All who honored her despise her, for they have seen her nakedness. She herself groans and turns her face away. All her people groan as they search for bread. They take their treasures for food to revive their strength. Look, O Lord, and see, for I am despised. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Look and see if there's any sorrow like my sorrow, which was brought upon me, which the Lord inflicted on the day of his fierce anger. Jeremiah is describing the city of Jerusalem. And as Jeremiah watched, he saw people passing by the ruins. He was appalled at their reaction, or you might say, the lack of reaction. They didn't cry. They didn't laugh. They simply walked by showing no emotion or concern at all. And so Jeremiah questions them and he says, is it nothing to you? Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? They were insensitive to what was going on. It just didn't matter to them. And I want us to think about that question this morning. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? In this day and age of terrorism, of war, of racial division, of political strife, if we aren't careful, we will forget that God has made of all men one blood. When we read about hundreds of thousands of children dying because of war or from starvation, or when we hear that one third of the world's population will go to bed hungry tonight, what does it do to us? When we contemplate that there are literally hundreds of millions of souls who live, who die each day without Christ, how does that make us feel? How sensitive are we to the plight of others? Now I want you to think about this statement with me. As you reflect, And all of you here have studied the life of Christ over and over again. As you reflect on your understanding of Christ and your understanding of how Christ lived his life and what Christ taught about life, would you agree with me that he not only expects, but he commands his people to be loving and caring people? You think about that for a moment. We are to be loving and caring people. In spite of the time in which we live, in spite of how easy it is to close ourselves off and it being easy to cast off the rest of the world, we are still called, his people, still called to be loving and caring people. Now that was a long introduction to get us to this place. Here are some thoughts along that line. Number one, there are many people in this world who are uncaring. Some years ago, a woman drowned in the waters of Lake Michigan, and as she was drowning, she cried out for help, and three men heard her cries, but they just watched her drown. When they were questioned about the why of that, they talked about how cold the waters were. I think there was a scene like that reported recently on national news of a very similar incident where someone was drowning and others stood by and only watched. There's a Sunday evening program on TV called War Stories. Those stories come out of many of the wars that we have been involved in. And I'm always amazed, and particularly when you look at World War II, I'm always amazed at the atrocities that were directed towards civilians. It is only the devil himself that could cause that much man's inhumanity to man. The question is not, are we sensitive to the needs of others, as much as it is, why do we tend to be so insensitive? And I would suggest a couple of things there. Viktor Frankl, who was a prisoner of Nazi Germany during World War II, he wrote about his experiences, and in his book he tells about the emotional stages that a prisoner of war goes through. He wrote that the final and most awful stage of all is one where the prisoner actually ends up, in his words, murdering his own emotions. Frankl writes and he says, because you can only view human suffering for so long, if you are sensitive, if you are compassionate, then it hurts. And so finally, when you have seen so much suffering, you kill your own emotions. The result is that you can watch your friend being knocked down and picked up, knocked down again, and never look the other way and never feel anything. It becomes a defense mechanism that we use to shield ourselves because we don't want to hurt anymore. Maybe our 24-hour news cycle has done that for us. Every time we pick up a newspaper or every time we turn on the TV, we hear of more human suffering. And maybe we have heard so much. Maybe we have cried all the tears that we can cry. Maybe we felt all the sympathy that we can feel. And finally, we have murdered our own emotions. And we get to a place where we can sit stoically and look at all of it, and it never touch our life. It never causes us to weep. It never registers any emotion at all. Maybe that's the safe place to be, a place where we can't hurt anymore. Is that where Christ wants us to be? Then I also think we tend to be insensitive because it costs something. It always costs something for us to be sensitive. It costs something for us to care. And a prime example of that, of course, is the story of the Good Samaritan, which Jesus told, found in Luke chapter 10. As you remember, a man was going down from Jerusalem, and that man was on a road. Robbers came. They beat him. They left him for dead. And then as he was lying there, two came by, a priest and a Levite, on separate occasions, two who should have been readily helpers, but they passed by and they were going, no doubt, to keep their appointments, and they were going to do that. The Samaritan, he dared to stop, and you know it cost him something to do that. It cost him time. It cost him possessions. He used the things that he had to bind up the man's wounds. It cost him money because he paid the innkeeper to keep the man until he was well again. It cost him, but he was the only one in the whole story that is called good. It always costs something when you dare to care. a year or so ago. You probably read about it or heard it. A young medical student was driving late at night in New Orleans, and as he stopped at a stop sign, he looked down the street and he saw a man dragging a woman toward his car, and he saw the trunk of the car was open. The medical student drove towards the vehicle. He got out and he confronted the man. The man pulled a pistol, shot the medical student in the stomach, and he left the medical student, of course, there, but he did leave the woman there as well and fled the scene. The woman survived and the medical student survived. Now, some would look at that and say the medical student was crazy. Why did he do that? Or why didn't he do something else? Why didn't he take other kinds of precautions? I'm sure the woman, though, considered him a savior to her. I wonder what he thought about himself. In that hospital bed, do you suppose that he wondered if he had just drove on through that intersection? No one would have ever known. All he had to do was turn his head the other way and start driving. I wonder if he thought, well, if I had done that, I wouldn't be laying here in this hospital bed. It cost him something to care. It cost him something to care. And so my first thought is that it's easy to be insensitive because we are bombarded by troubles, and it's easy because being sensitive is always going to cost us something. Second thought is, whenever we are uncaring, we play into the hands of the devil, we play into the hands of evil. C.S. Lewis, in his classic book, Screwtape Letters, he records a conversation in his mind taking place between Satan and his nephew Wormwood, an apprentice devil, and it goes something like this. Satan is talking to Wormwood and he says, "Now your task, your assignment, is not to go out and make bad people. I'll take care of that. I'll supply the world with an abundant number of evil people to do evil things. But what I want you to do is to cause good people to do nothing. That is all you have to do. Just make all of your people comfortable. Cause them to be content with things as they are. If they ever begin to think seriously about anything of great importance, get them to think instead about what they're going to eat at their next meal. Cause them to worry about their digestive system. Get their attention off of whatever is important and keep them comfortable. You just keep good men doing nothing. I'll supply the world with evil men." And you know, in many ways, Wormwood has done a good job. I recently read of a man by the name of William Wilberforce, and he was a member of the English Parliament who vigorously crusaded against slavery in the late 1700s. In 1789, he authored and presented a bill before Parliament that would have made it unlawful for Englishmen to sell slaves to the brand new United States of America. And England, of course, at that time, with their system of colonies, it was the most dominant nation in all of the world. Wilberforce presented his bill twice in Parliament, and it was tabled both times. On the third occasion, he had crusaded and worked so hard that he had convinced what he thought was going to be enough people to vote to pass his bill. On the night that it came up for a vote for the third time, a comic opera appeared in London, and 12 members of Parliament who had said they supported Wilberforce's bill, they went to the opera instead of Parliament. And at the very time that they were applauding the new opera, the vote was taken and the bill was defeated 74-70, and the vote wasn't to be changed. It makes you wonder how much suffering and how much misery occurred, maybe could have been prevented, because 12 men went to the opera instead of taking care of their responsibilities. I venture to say that as terrible a threat as terrorism is, or materialism is, it would be hard to convince me that the greater threat arises when good men and good women who are children of God become insensitive to the needs of others. To not care, to not be sensitive, that's to play into the hands of the devil. Is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? Third and final conclusion I draw is this, and it's a positive one, and it is that there are still a lot of good, caring people. And I believe that this congregation is filled with people who have hearts, not just for each other, not just for those within the walls of this building, but outside of the walls of this building as well. I'm thankful to be a part of a congregation that does so much good, not only here at home, but reaches out to so many parts of our world. And so let's not any of us think, oh, I can't do any good. In reality, you are doing much good. And that is a part of being a follower of Christ, to be a loving and a caring Christian. There is power in one person who determines to do good in the name of Christ. And that's the conclusion of the matter. This lesson, if we're children of God, then we're going to do what we can as a loving, caring Christian. A door may not be open to us where we can help the masses, but maybe we can benefit one person. Perhaps it will be a cup of cold water offered in the name of Christ, but it will be recognized because we care. And one writer put it this way, we may sometimes become weary in well-doing, but we will continue to do well. Our shoulders may sometimes slump because we are tired, but they will never shrug because we are indifferent. And when someone says, is it nothing to you, all you who pass by? As a child of God, we will respond, it is something to me. I cannot pass by on the other side. I care because he cared. I love because he first loved. The greatest thing that we can do for others is to share with them the gospel of Jesus Christ. Every person needs to be saved. The care of souls is the most important thing that we can do. We have selected a song Mike has as an inviting hymn this morning. In this part of the service, we encourage you to become a Christian if you haven't already become one. The invitation song is to encourage you to step out of the aisle, make your way forward, confess your faith in Jesus Christ as the Son of God, turn from your sins and repentance, and be buried with Christ in baptism for the remission of sins. If you're at that place in your life, I pray you'll come as we stand and as we sing.